studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the latter part of the 1920s, before the unraveling of the world economy with the Great Depression, recording companies scoured the globe looking for artists to record with an emergent technology. Driven simply by the desire to make a buck, the company's agents recorded onto shellac discs Cuban son, Indonesian kronkong, Spanish flamenco, Hawaiian hula, and Argentine tango, among other styles of music. They opened up the ears of listeners around the world, bringing the music of unknown working-class artists to largely working-class audiences elsewhere. These recordings facilitated a transformation of the music of daily life, and, as historian Michael Denning argues, inadvertently fueled the cultural politics that was to manifest itself later in powerful waves of political decolonization. Denning teaches American Studies at Yale University and is the co-director of Yale's Initiative on Labor and Culture. He's the author of Noise Uprising, The Audio Politics of a World Musical Revolution. Michael, I'd like to ask you about music and politics. Most of the music that was recorded in the period 1925 to 1930 was, in fact, not explicitly political. But you argue that music, by its very essence, is social and political. Can you tell us why?
One way I think of it is in terms of the difference between a social consciousness and a political unconscious. There's certainly some music which has a social consciousness, which is politically, which is explicitly done that way. And indeed, some of the songs that I talk about are in that vein. But I was actually more interested in this book in the kind of, since many of these were really dance musics, in the kind of political unconscious that a music has. And it does seem to me that music traditionally has been a way of bringing people together in formations of one sort or another, choruses, dances, bringing bodies together to sound. And as a result, there's a way in which the forms of togetherness that, or the forms of gathering that music produces sonically become figures or allegories or imaginations of social belonging, positively or negatively. And as a result, from the top in many ways, governments and states and regimes and institutions have often used music to build solidarity, which is why militaries have always had music. Schools and colleges and marching bands have had that. But also that social movements have often drawn not just on songs that have an explicit political message, but on sounds that bring people together for in various kinds of ways. So that's one element of it. The other thing is I was quite taken by an argument that was made by a French politician and economist many years ago, Jacques Attali, in a book called Noise, where he suggested that music did not follow political events and reflect them, but that music was in some ways prophetic of social, because it was a kind of exercise of the social imagination, it prophesied ways of social living to come. And whether or not that's exactly true or could be proved, let's say, it always seemed to me a very powerful way to think with. And it does seem to me that there's ways in which people work out their relationships, whether their personal relationships, since music is often about romance and love, or their social relationships that then actually then take social form in communities and societies. And so that was part of the sense in this book, was that if one of the most important events of the 20th century is the decolonization of the world, that at the beginning of the 20th century, two-thirds or three-quarters of the world was under colonial domination. And one of the things that's happened through the 20th century was the political independence of over 100 new nations around the world. That part of that political story was a cultural revolution that actually required the decolonization of the ear, and that in some ways that took place, or at least that's part of the argument of the book, that that took place before the actual political decolonization, and that that musical decolonization prepared the way in some ways for a political decolonization.
And we'll talk a lot more about that music itself as it came, as it was shaped in the context of empire, and the argument that you're making about the role that it played in the breakup of those empires. But I would like to ask you about the specifics of a particular moment. That is the moment in 1925 where there was the introduction of electrical recordings, and there was about a 5-year period, which was then delimited by the Great Depression, where gramophone companies went out and recorded musicians from all over the world. I will ask you much more about who these musicians were, but can you just tell us about the technological and economic conditions that allowed for this moment?
It could start with the technology in some sense, that the invention of electrical recording, which was to record with microphones and then to play back through loudspeakers, as opposed to the earlier version where literally the vibrations from a singer's voice or the instrument were etched onto the disc and was called acoustic one, that electrical recording gave two things. One, a much greater degree of fidelity, so that all kinds of musics that had never really sounded that good on the acoustic recording, particularly plucked stringed instruments like guitars, were now able to be recorded, but also recorded much more inexpensively. And so phonographs become much more inexpensive. The first quarter of the 20th century, the phonograph is basically a parlor furniture in elite families around the world. And all of a sudden in the 1920s, phonographs turn up in all kinds of ordinary people's worlds, not necessarily in their household immediately, but in bars, in shops. It was a way to bring people, customers in. And so recorded music, gramophones in the English use, phonographs in the American use, and I go back and forth between those two, become much more part of ordinary popular life. And as a result, the recording companies begin to wonder, what kind of music could we sell? Because they had started by recording the most highly prestigious and the most cultivated kinds of music in the first part of the century. And all of a sudden, in the mid-20s, there's an idea to go out and start recording essentially forms of urban dance music to sell to local audiences. And so the big recording companies will send people to Havana or to Rio or to Cairo and to Atlanta, Bristol, Tennessee, and find local musicians, record them, and then in order to sell to people in Havana, Rio, Cairo, Atlanta. It's not originally imagined as, you know, recording the music to sell it back in New York or in Paris or in London, though some of the musics will really become very popular and move around the world. But the original idea is, and for 5 years, and they don't really know what they're looking for, which is what's so fascinating about this moment. They basically record anyone that walks in front of the microphone and hopes it sells. It's kind of it's like the dot-com boom in a certain way. And it also is like the dot-com boom in that it goes bust. The Depression hits in 1929, and by 1931, they're sitting on piles of records that don't sell. And people in the heart of the Depression, this is one thing that people stop by. And so for a very brief moment, all of these musics that had been heard around the world in local communities are now being heard out of earshot, that are moving around the world on these disc forms.
And how did these discs become disseminated widely? And these discs, of course, made of shellac, as you say, a new technology. And you were just saying that the intended audience was local to the areas where the music originated. So how did they end up fueling all sorts of crazes, especially in the metropolitan cities of what we might now think of as the global north, but not just in the global north? How did that happen?
Well, one of the ways that it happens is because I think the kinds of cities that are really crucial to this story are port cities. And that many of that ports become around the world the place where people and goods are moving in a worldwide colonial economy. And migrants are coming to port cities from the countryside and are bringing various forms of folk musics, rural musics with rural instruments, but are now playing them in urban dance halls. And at the same time, that's actually how the recording engineers are taking steamships to arrive in a port city and record people. And as a result, it's often, in fact, sailors and seamen who are the people who are bringing the records from one port to another, and that you can actually follow the tracking of these records as they move from port to port. And so in some sense, this becomes not really the story of national musics, not necessarily the story of Cuban music or Argentinian music or whatever, but the musics of Havana, of Cape Town, of Accra, of Rio, of these ports that are connected by steamship lines that are really become the crucial in the world before, right, airplane travel. The steamships are the linking of these empires politically, culturally, and economically. And that the record, because it is a relatively cheap, a relatively portable, though piling up the discs, shellac discs were heavier than MP3s in that sense. But nonetheless, compared to earlier ways of moving music or moving musicians, it really did move the music around the world with a kind of, or to take the other example, earlier on, the earlier form of mass musical culture was sheet music. And indeed, there is popular sheet music. People may know about this because they're in kind of used bookstores and flea markets and whatever. People collect those with colored covers and then a piano reduction and the lyrics. And that goes back to the 19th century of kind of popular sheet music. And that actually distributed songs around the world, but not the sounds. In many ways, it reduced the different musics to a kind of simple piano reduction that you could play in the parlor on your piano. And what the gramophone or the phonograph did was it brought not just Hawaiian songs, but it brought the sounds of Hawaiian singers, the sounds of Hawaiian instruments all around the world. And that becomes one of the central things of this five-year period that I think really has fundamentally changes the way in which we experience popular or vernacular musics forever.
That tremendous shift of bringing the performance of the music and not just the script of the music in effect around the world obviously had all sorts of implications. But was there anything lost in the eclipse of printed music where people would then perform the music themselves?
Well, I guess I don't really see too many losses in that way. Later on, if we talk about what happens over the next century with the impact of recorded music and a worldwide music industry, there are other things. But at this stage, I think that one the striking thing is actually what this opens up for music. At this point, it really has not destroyed live music. By all accounts, most of these recordings are thought of as ancillary. The musicians are not making money from the recording, so that they're still imagining their main audience is live audiences in particular places. Often people first buy these records, and the musicians say this at the time, as souvenirs. Kulthum, the great Egyptian singer, says at one point in her autobiography, she would sing at weddings, and then people would buy the records because they wanted a record of that girl who sang at the family's wedding. And so I'm not sure at this point it really has not transformed that kind of relation to live music. It changes how music is learned, that all of a sudden you get any number of stories of young musicians who have not been taught to read notated music or even have the notations of the musics they're interested in, listening to records over and over again, trying to copy the articulations, the sounds, and things like that. And so you get, you know, famous examples of Crossing the Ocean. The young French gypsy guitarist Django Reinhardt listening over and over again to the records of Louis Armstrong and inventing a kind of gypsy jazz out of that. And so you get these intriguing crossovers of music as a result of people listening to records of musics that they didn't have access to within earshot.
That's the voice of Michael Denning. He is the author of Noise Uprising, The Audio Politics of a World Musical Revolution. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So let's stick for a moment with the kind of geographic origins of this music and its cross-pollination. You were talking about port cities being fundamental for what might be called now a kind of globalization of this music. But would it be fair to say that regions were key in looking at this music, that it wasn't simply that things were going every which way around the world and that there were arcs of port cities that particularly brought certain musics together?
Yeah, though I must say, and I make such an argument in the book, though it is a tentative argument. In fact, much of this book is intended to start a conversation, to start a debate, rather than to end that debate. And so one of the issues was trying to think, I generally would like to sense that there is more commonality among these musics than is often thought to be. The way in which we receive them now, both in the record stores or on iTunes in a way, or in musical scholarship and music writing, is as tied to different nations. There's Argentine tango, there's Brazilian samba, jazz is American. Each country sort of has its own one of these vernacular musics. And at this moment, I think there's a lot more crossing of those, and that it's not as clear that they have been nationalized, and there are things that they share in some ways. One of the analogies I use is the moment when the various European Romance musics' languages emerge out of Latin. And so one sees that there are commonalities between French and Spanish and Italian. They're not identical languages, but they have a certain kind of common legacies and common things. And it does seem to me in some ways the relation between jazz and tango and samba is not unlike that relation of the vernacular languages. The fact that you end up growing up speaking, so to speak, one of those musical idioms doesn't mean that you can easily speak another one. But on the other hand, they're not entirely different from each other. But on the other hand, it does seem to me there are at least three different arcs of the music which are more different than that. There's clearly a set of musics of the Black Atlantic, musics that are really impressed by the enslavement of Africans and the middle passage to the Americas and the creation of slave societies and post-slave societies in the Americas that generated powerful kind of intermixing of European and African musics that we think of as African-American music in the widest sense, in the sense that even American country music, deeply impacted as much by Africa as Europe, is a form of African-American music. And so I think there is a kind of family resemblance between jazz and Cuban song and Brazilian samba and calypso and that influence goes across to Africa as well. There's a second set of musics that really emerge around the mixtures of the Mediterranean, of North African, of Middle Eastern, of gypsy musics with European musics. And again, one thinks of musics like flamenco or Portuguese fado or rebetika in Greece that will be more that kind of a mixture. And then there's clearly a family of these vernacular musics that come out of the Pacific, deeply what I call the polyphonic Polynesian Pacific. The one that becomes most famous and most popular will be Hawaiian music, which has a remarkable kind of echo or resonance around the world in this period. And so there are connections between those three arcs, but in some ways they're slightly different from each other in terms of their musical idioms and vocabularies, the instruments that are used, things like that.
Well, you are arguing that this moment, the moment from 1925 to 1930, when recording companies recorded these, what I guess we would call folk musicians all over the world, was the pivotal moment for music in the 20th century. Can you tell us why you're suggesting that?
I guess at two different levels. On the one level is the really wide historical, century-long thing that just as the invention of various forms of musical notation somewhere in the early Middle Ages really changed the way in which music was experienced in lots of ways and gave us the whole tradition that we think of as classical or philharmonic music in a way, or which really is music dependent in ways on notation, and the sense that there are the central figures or composers who are the people who write down those notations and then performers perform them in different ways, that the gramophone revolution is as large a revolution as that notation revolution was several hundred years earlier, and that in some ways it actually puts notation somewhat to the side, that all of a sudden the way in which we experience music just day to day is in terms of recorded music. The way musicians inscribe their music is less as written documents or something like that than as these recordings. And so in one sense, that I think we're still at the beginning of. We're still in the first century of living with recorded music. And so I'm not even sure we know the full consequences of what that means for musical life. The second way in which I think it's that powerful one really has to do with its centrality to that story of decolonization, which I think is in many ways the fundamental story of the 20th century, and that the political and economic revolution that created the world that we think of as globalization, which is this, you know, number of independent countries that had been colonial territories and dominated by the three or four European empires, had a kind of cultural revolution that, again, I think in many ways we're still reckoning with. That all of a sudden, musics that had not been respected, musics that were often associated with the despised and oppressed parts of particular societies at that point, become in a very short time revalued, imagined as a kind of part of the central to a nation's culture and a nation's personality or character in that kind of way. And that's really a remarkable change. And as a result, many of the and the other sense is that many of the vernacular musics that we listen to that are central to the international music industry have their, and this is their word in some way, roots in the musics that were recorded in this 5 to 10 year period. That any number of musics have gone back and tried to cover those songs. One can find lovingly curated box sets of these musics. In some sense, it's kind of what I think of it, to use a film example, is that just as the films of Chaplin and Griffith kind of invented the vocabulary, those first couple decades of silent film invented the vocabulary for film, that these records are kind of the equivalent of that moment of early film for recorded music. They invent the vocabulary that indeed we're still playing with, and that musicians are still putting different ways of listening and playing that.
Well, let's take a listen to a song that has been covered by multiple performers, as you are indicating. This is El Manicero, or The Peanut Vendor, by Trio Matamoros.
Caserita, no te acuestes a dormir sin comer tu cucurucho de maní. Qué sabrosito y rico está, ya no se puede pedir más. Ay, caserita, no me dejes ir, porque después te vas a arrepentir y va a ser muy tarde ya. Manicero se va, caserita no te acuestes a dormir sin comerte un cucurucho de maní. Cuando la calle sola está, casera de mi corazón, el manicero entona su pregón. Y si la niña escucha mi cantar, yo amaré de su balcón. Dame de tu maní, que esta noche no voy a poder dormir sin comerte un cucurucho de maní. Manicero se va.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Michael Denning about his book, Noise Uprising, The Audio Politics of a World Musical Revolution. That's published by Verso, and in it, he talks about the period from roughly 1925 to 1930 when recording companies recorded musicians all over the world, bringing to global audiences music that had not been heard before. And he argues that this moment represents something very profound and was a pivotal moment for the 20th century. I wonder if you can talk a bit more about the shift that took place at this moment and why it was so significant. How did this music, which you've termed vernacular music, change the experience of music in everyday life? How did it shift the uses of music from music used in specific functions, you know, such as in the church or in weddings, to the way we think of music today as part of the soundscape of daily life?
Yeah, and I might even go further and say that this kind of music actually invented what we think of as daily life in the first place, that we might not have known what daily life was without this kind of music, that perhaps oversimplifying or whatever, but traditionally, particularly live musics, had occasions of various sort. And in most musical cultures, different kinds of music were specific for different occasions. And there was music that was for dancing and for social occasions. There was music that was for worship and for religious and sacred occasions. There was music that was tied to public festivals and national festivals. So there's music that's connected to funerals and to memorials, and a long sense that in many ways there's a kind of functional element of music. And usually in musicology, this is then contrasted to the tradition of composed music, which is thought to be more autonomous, which artists are trying to just write music for music's sake. And what's intriguing to me about the form of the record was that it sort of was between either of those, and it ended up becoming a kind of music that was meant to be the soundtrack to daily life, that was just played in the background one way or another, that one could have the record player coming, or it moves very quickly onto the radio when that is, and so the radio is on behind work. They aren't exactly work songs in the traditional sense, but they are songs that are being played while at work. They're songs that are going on in the household. There's songs that are taking place in recordings inside street life. There's any number of accounts of early street musicians who are not playing instruments but are wheeling record players around the streets and are playing records in the street and are asking for contributions and donations to play records, kind of gramophone minstrels in that way. And in some sense, one of the things that I think was one of the El Manicero, the peanut vendor, captured this because it was one of many songs in this generation that actually took as its subject street vendors, people who would have songs or calls, musical calls, that were part of selling something, in this case, peanuts, money, money, and would sing that out and were part of the musical soundscape of the urban world of these port cities in the 1920s. And in some ways, one of the powers of that song was to take an emblem of street music and turn it into a kind of gramophone song, a phonograph song, and where actually the street singer is himself or herself a kind of peanut vendor, someone who's selling their songs. And I guess that would be another way of thinking the politics. Often politics is not just about protesting one particular abuse or standing up for a particular cause or change. One of the powerful elements of democratic politics has been to insist on the dignity and respect for ordinary life and ordinary people. And in some sense, the making of the stories of daily life in the street part of music, to hear those voices, to put the street vendor's song into a popular song that echoes around the world, is, I think, a very powerful political transformation that takes place. And takes place in different ways, because that song had one kind of resonance in Cuba, where it really and another resonance when it turned into a kind of more exotic tourist song. The lyrics were changed to turn it into not a story of daily life in Havana, but a story that was an emblem of Cuba in New York or in Paris in that way. And so the songs have different kinds of valences in different places as well. And there's a kind of battle over the meaning of these songs, which I think is part of, to go back to your first question, of the audio politics. It's not like songs have just one single politics, but that the battle over sound is part of the political and cultural battles of any society.
Sure, and it and that really touches on a number of things, because as you say, what may have indicated in the countries and regions where the music was emanating some sort of claim to an identity that one could see some connection to, you know, going beyond empire and fueling the struggles for decolonization in another part of the world could be about the exotica of what later would become the third world. And so I wonder if you could relate in thinking about the complexity of music. You've been talking a lot about the almost liberatory aspects of this surge, or at least the recording of this surge of music in the late 1920s, but how do you also see it as relating to capitalism and the expansion of consumption in daily life that was taking place at that time? So there's a chronicling of daily life, but is there not a sort of complex other side too in looking at the role of commodified music in that context?
Yes, but I guess that I felt that much of the political analysis of commodified popular music has emphasized that part, the sense that this music has been indeed expropriated. Oftentimes the musicians were not paid for the music, gotten no royalties over the years. The accounts of the various forms of exploitation that the music industry and the larger entertainment industry has had, and also the sense in which this has turned us into listeners of records rather than players of instruments, of making music together. That's a very strong and, I must say, probably a way of thinking about music that I imbibed and am willing to do it. But in some sense, this book was meant to turn the table slightly on that story, to actually argue that with all of the attempt to turn music into a commodity and make it a commodity, there is something very powerful about musical the great word from Christopher Small, musicking. He always says that the trouble was we always put music in a noun, and that was actually a product of that process of commodification, that somehow music is a thing, and the record, in fact, made it even more thing-like, but that actually the form is really musicking, that there should be a verb, and that even when one's listening to music, one is musicking, when one's listening to it with other people, or even by one oneself, and to try to capture what were the social and political energies that come out of musicking, and particularly musicking from below, musicking of music that was not respected, that was disrespected in many kinds of ways, and that all of a sudden gets, to kind of use a voting metaphor, enfranchised. This is like the granting of the vote to whole sets of music and musicians who had never had the vote, so to speak, in a musical sense, who were not thought to be serious musicians, whose music wasn't written down and played in courts or in concert halls, but was really in the dance halls, in the brothels, in the vice districts of these different cities. And so I guess my sense was less to accent the way in which these were commodified, though I think if one reads the book, one will find much of that story there, but to try to see the actual energies that emerge outside of that commodification. In this way, ironically, I think the capitalist record companies, which did not want to promote decolonization, actually promoted decolonization, ironically, by allowing these records to circulate. In some ways, because one of the intriguing stories that I came across is that records were much harder to censor. Partly because the censorship laws had been set against printed material, and that printed material was easier to look at by censors and read and whatever. And there are any number of stories of records, which after all, if you just look at them, are this black piece of shellac, and that if you did not understand the language or the idiom or the way of singing, the words might not be even intelligible to the European colonial censor. And so there's a number of cases where indeed various forms of political statements or metaphorical political statements get circulated by record that actually would have been prohibited in newspapers or pamphlet or print media. So that for a brief moment there, the phonograph record becomes a vehicle for a new kind of politics. And particularly in some parts of the world, and again, this will have that the first question of how much of this was conscious or unconscious. In some places where the anti-colonial movement is taking place right then, in the 1920s and early 30s, it's very straightforward. So in India, where this is the moment after Gandhi's non-cooperation movement and major kinds of social movements for Indian independence from the British Empire, that popular singers are actually recording records in support of Gandhi and in support of Indian nationalism and things like that. And so one finds that around the strike wave in the Caribbean, that there are songs recorded by Calypsonians about the strikes that are taking place in Trinidad. In other cases, Hawaii is probably a good case of this, where the Hawaiian independence had been defeated at the turn of the century, and there is very little explicit political opposition to essentially the conquest of Hawaii by the United States by the 1920s. And there the music is much more hidden. And you would have to look for this, and maybe another person listening would not hear the same thing. But let me suggest, Hawaiian music has rarely gotten much respect, has often been thought of as the kind of quintessential tourist music, romantic images of the winds and beaches that are marketed and were indeed highly successful, not just in the United States, but in England, in India, around the world. And yet, if you actually listen to the records, songs sung by Hawaiians in the Hawaiian language, which was being moved out of the schools at that time, that celebrate the land, and the, so much of the dispossession of Hawaii had been the dispossession of land from native Hawaiians, that in some sense those songs that seem simple songs about the land actually become powerful evocations of a kind of Native American culture, a Native Hawaiian culture that was under stress. And I think that actually becomes recognized. It's not that I see this in particular, but by the Hawaiian Renaissance of the 1970s and 1980s, you find indeed Hawaiian musicians and activists rethinking that music of the 1920s and 1930s and hearing that kind of hidden alternative meaning in those songs.
Following on that thread, let's take a listen to a recording from that period by the Hawaiian Kalamas Quartet.
Anohana Hawaii la, leikanehua la.
That is the Kalamas Quartet. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Michael Denning. He is professor of American Studies at Yale University and the co-director of Yale's Initiative on Labor and Culture. We're talking about his book, Noise Uprising, The Audio Politics of a World Musical Revolution. And we're talking about the recordings that took place between 1925 and 1930, roughly, that brought to new audiences a new kind of music, which Denning refers to as vernacular. So you mentioned a moment ago the rediscovery in Hawaii in the 1970s of music from the 1920s. And I wanted to ask you about that recovery, a rediscovery of this music and how it has shaped the way that music continues to be made.
Yeah, and that's a way to say something about how I ended up writing this book in the first place. Because I was very much a product of what in the U.S. was called the folk revival in the 1960s and 1970s, and the sense where all of a sudden there was a repackaging of the records that had been made in this period, the late 1920s and early 1930s, that were the early blues recordings, early jazz recordings, early country, or as it was known at the time, hillbilly music. And that those were repackaged on LPs in that generation. The famous Harry Smith Anthology of American Folk Music was really not folk music. It was a bootlegged version of these recordings that had been made back in the 1920s by Mississippi John Hurt and other figures like that. And so in that sense, I came into this project with a real sense that the revival of American musics of a whole variety, from jazz to soul to rock to rap, was in many ways dependent on this idea that there was a roots music, that blues and jazz and country had its origins in this particular moment in the late 20s and 30s. I almost felt like that part of the story I kind of grew up with. Anyone who had listened to Bob Dylan, Dylan had to this day ransacks those records and those songs and rewrites their lyrics constantly. And I think what struck me on a couple of trips that I made at various points was seeing this same narrative take place in other parts of the world, that indeed at the same time that blues singers are being discovered, famously working, Furry Lewis, I think, is discovered working in a car wash in Memphis and is then brought back, and at Newport Folk Festival, the musicians that had recorded back in the 20s, now much older, are brought back. That the same thing in Brazil, that all of a sudden one of the great samba singers of the 20s and 30s, Cartola, is rediscovered, in quotes, in the 50s and early 60s and has a club. And it becomes part of a kind of Brazilian folk revival. And so one of these things will happen in the 1960s and 70s, these parallel revivals, partly against the sense that there is a kind of completely commodified and commercialized music which is controlled by the music industry. A whole generation of people will try to recover these musics. And that's taken place in a number of places around the world, not always at the same time. Sometimes it was as early as the 50s, sometimes in the 70s, sometimes not till the 80s and 90s. Sometimes the records themselves had apparently been lost and then recovered much later. One of the early people who wrote a fascinating book, Andrew Jones, about the Chinese records from Shanghai of this period in the 1930s, assumed, because everyone assumed it, that these records didn't even exist anymore, that they had pretty much been destroyed through years of war and revolution in China. And then all of a sudden, EMI found a warehouse full of them in India, because that's where they had actually been pressed before they were shipped to China to sell to the Chinese market. And so by the 90s and the early 2000s, all of these Chinese Chinese records from the 1930s are being re-released on CDs and then later on MP3s. And so there is this kind of continual sense, sometimes with more radical, in number cases, social movements and radical political forces will latch on to these musics to build a kind of usable past for the social movement. In other cases, post-colonial regimes, sometimes authoritarian regimes, now having won political independence, will want to create a national music. And in many cases, these roots musics were then employed by the regime to kind of create a national music. One of the intriguing cases of that is Kroncin in Indonesia. And I must say, in all of this, I feel like I'm at the edges of my expertise. I've tried to learn as much about lots of these musics, but I'm sure there are many mistakes. The book is right now being translated into Indonesian. It'll be interesting whether or not there are criticisms and whatever. But that was one of the cases where Kroncin really gets tied to the Indonesian revolution against the Dutch. But by the 1960s and 70s, it becomes part of the regime's kind of national music. And as a result, younger people end up bored with it, see it as a kind of official music, and become less interested in this music. And it's only in recent years that there's been, again, a revival of that. And so the musics can often have the same music, can have different political connotations and consequences in different times.
Well, I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. I've been speaking with Michael Denning. He is the author of Noise Uprising, The Audio Politics of a World Musical Revolution. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He is also the author of The Cultural Front and Culture in the Age of Three Worlds. He teaches American Studies at Yale University and is the co-director of Yale's Initiative on Labor and Culture. Michael, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.